This is Ben Habib for Politics Albury Wodonga. In this podcast, I'm joined in conversation by Professor Judith Brett, who's the head of school in the School of Social Sciences at La Trobe University. And we're going to discuss her recent quarterly essay, Fair Share, Country and City in Australia. In Fair Share, Judith argues that our federation was built on the idea of a big country and a fair share, no matter where someone lived. This tradition looked to the bush for our legends, and we still look to it for our food. And these are not things that we can just abandon. However, in the current parliament, with country independents deciding who would form the federal government in the hung parliament, it seems that rural and regional Australia's time had come again. But as the Murray-Darling water reform shows, the politics of dependence between city and country are complicated. So the question remains, which is explored in this essay. What will be the fate of the country in an era of user pays, water cutbacks, climate change, droughts and flooding rains? What are the prospects for a new compact between country and city in Australia in the 21st century? These are questions we're going to explore in today's discussion, some of which are loosely based on observations and experiences from my own life living in the country and the city. So I hope you enjoy this conversation with Judith Brett. Okay, I'm joined today by Professor Judith Brett, who's the head of school in the School of Social Sciences at La Trobe University. Judy, thanks for agreeing to the interview.
No, it's much a pleasure.
Appreciated. You've spent some time in Albury Wodonga in years past. Can you tell us about your involvement with the community?
Well, it was really more just teaching. I would go up to teach first year Australian politics and also public policy. And what I tried to do was, when it was a subject that I was teaching, I tried to go up fortnightly, so that there was a bit of continuity, and I would go up on the train, really, get a whole lot of reading done.
Back when it worked.
Yeah, it doesn't, yeah.
It works again now, but it's been a long way from there to here.
And I enjoyed teaching the students up there. One year I had a very good lot of students from social work and welfare students who were doing some Australian politics, and I thought that worked really well. Found them interesting.
Yeah, it's a good mix up there. Yeah. A different cohort too.
Yeah, that's right. There was quite a lot of older people, I suppose, retraining to go into some sort of social work, welfare sort of position.
Yeah, and I personally like having those people in the class because they're a great influence on the young students who are very raw coming out of high school.
Yeah, and also I learnt a bit from them too because they had a different experience. They lived in the country, and there was also quite students from New South Wales. So when I was teaching about rural politics, that was really interesting for me because some of them came from old Country Party, now National Party areas, and I got a very good sense from them of the way that was really embedded in people's sense of identity in many of those. I guess it was the sort of Riverina area, really.
Yeah, that's a good segue into what I'm going to talk about now, because a lot of our young student cohort are kids that come from small towns in the Riverina and they need to get out. They need to broaden their horizons, do something new. And Sydney and Melbourne are too big, so they come to Albury Wodonga. It's the right fit for them. Now, I look back at when I was growing up, and when I was 18, I grew up in Mount Gambier in South Australia. I had to escape my hometown as well, where there's a lot of intellectual and social conservatism, and as someone as a bright and sensitive young male, such a place is not always a good place to be in your formative years. So what I've seen from my experiences is that there tends to be a positive feedback loop of a brain drain from the country to the city, where talented and bright young people have to leave or want to leave to get education or work or to just look for something different, which has an effect on the intellectual and cultural and social capital of the town that they leave behind. So could you comment on that?
Well, you know, I think it's not just a sort of Australian Victorian 20th century problem. It's sort of like it was ever thus in some ways. I think one of the problems for Australia is that we have the big capital cities and we don't have very many medium-sized cities, so that the drain tends to take a lot out of the area. Whereas if you think of, say, a country like Germany, it's not as if everybody wants to be in Berlin or everybody wanted to be in Bonn. You've got medium-sized towns which have cultural infrastructure dotted all around, and so people can move, but they're not moving so far away. And I think there's a problem about the settlement patterns in Australia, which contributes to that. I mean, people have always wanted to get away from the small village, or some people have wanted to stay, but, you know, there's the young people. It's been a long pattern, but in Australia it has this particular problem because of the dominance of the capital cities. I mean, I must say, I think in the last decade or so, that's shifted a bit, it wasn't as much the case, say, in the 19th century, but certainly all through the middle of the 20th century, the capital cities were growing at the expense of the other cities. But now, if you think of Victoria, places like Bendigo and Ballarat and Shepparton and Wodonga are more culturally complex places, and Mildura. So I think that's been a positive development.
Yeah, I did notice that when I moved to Wodonga. I found the Albury-Wodonga area much more cosmopolitan than the Mount Gambier that I'd grown up with, even though there's a lot of similarities between the two places in terms of its social outlook, if you like.
Well, I think that, you know, the Kennett years, there was this move towards what some geographers call sponge cities. That is, a lot of country people think of the Kennett years as years in which there was a loss of services in the regions, but actually what there was a reorganisation of services so that some regional centres were, if you like, selected, and much better, particularly educational and health services, were put into those. Now, the smaller towns suffered, but actually the regional population as a whole benefited.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't have to come to Melbourne for specialist services in the same way.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, now what about, sort of, we've talked about the brain drain, what about drawing people, skilled people, back to the country? I was asked recently by one of our local commerce groups for advice about how do we attract skilled workers back to Albury-Wodonga. And I know in my own family experience, my parents, both primary school teachers, moved to Mount Gambier from Adelaide because at the time there was a compulsory scheme by the SA government to send city teachers to the country to fill the skills gap. And they decided to volunteer so they could choose where they went. So you talk about in your essay that there's a long history of planners post-World War II trying to direct skilled people to regional areas. Can you comment on that?
Well, I think one of the things is it's really hard to make people shift if they don't want to. I mean, that's one of the things we're seeing at the moment with the debate about West Australia and skill shortages. People don't necessarily want to shift. I mean, when I was at university, people who got a teaching studentship were obliged to do 3 years back in the country. But a lot of them then hightailed back to the city as fast as they could when that was ended. So it's actually quite difficult, I think. I mean, I think one of the aims of regional education, of putting higher education into regional towns, is not so much that what you do is attract skilled people back, but you put the capacity to skill up the people who are there.
Yeah, so they're of the community.
The community. And the government found when, you know, because there's always an issue about getting doctors into the country, that the people who are more likely, in terms of professionals, to want to work in the country, to work there as social workers or paramedical, are people who've grown up in the country and have got links to the community and like the lifestyle. So that the thing to do is to overcome the educational disadvantages that people in country areas have. Mm. Now, once you get more skilled people there, in a way you'll start to get some of the cultural infrastructure and things. Because I've got some friends who moved from the city and live in Wodonga, and that's because of various sort of sporting outdoor stuff that they were interested in. You know, there's a lot of attractions. But I think it's trying to skill up the population that's there is probably the best way to.
And that's really a long-term game, isn't it? It's not something that can be.
Well, it's all long-term,
So you've talked, one of the big themes in the essay is economic cross-subsidisation between the city and the country. How does that fit into this mix?
Well, I mean, what I was trying to do in the essay is to show that in the past, certainly up until the 70s, the cross-subsidisation, it was in a sense subsidisation that went both ways. The city got lots of benefits from the country because essentially our export income was earned by the farmers, by our agricultural products, by wool and wheat mainly. And sort of in return for that, at a sort of a big level, the city was prepared to let the country have cheaper services, you know, postage, telecommunications, power, all of the things that were delivered, the utilities delivered through government monopolies, which allowed all sorts of hidden cross subsidies to be in the pricing. But it was sort of part of a bigger deal where in other ways the country was earning most of the export income and having to pay quite high tariffs on their machinery and things. So it sort of, I mean, everybody always complains, but, you know, it sort of worked. I think the big change is that that agriculture is still important, but it's no longer anywhere near as important to our balance of payments and our and to trade as it used to be. And so it's harder for country people to argue plausibly for the sorts of service-based subsidies that they used to get.
Yeah.
And I think that's sort of what's happened.
Mm. Yep.
Though they still argue for it. I mean, the national broadband rollout is really based on that older model.
Yes, and a lot of people are saying that'll be a panacea for regional businesses. It'll escape the tyranny of distance. I remember when ABC TV's Q&A was in Albury last year, and Tony Windsor made that claim. He was on the panel.
There's
a couple of local business people that were excited.
And I mean, maybe you know, with some of the sort of businesses, the service industries that are growth, where people are selling intellectual property in, like, you know, design or accounting services or legal services, where perhaps place doesn't matter so much, maybe, you know, it will open up some opportunities. So, you know, that's good. I mean, I still wonder about the extent. I mean, there's still, people are still going to be attracted to the city for the sort of buzz of the city. And, you know, but different people want different things, I don't know.
Yeah, I can relate to that. It's one of the reasons I live in Wodonga now.
Yeah, well, one of my daughters has just moved to Bendigo, and she's a real sort of, you know, she grew up in Northcote, sort of inner city. And she's quite liking it, but I think she'd like a little bit more buzz.
Yeah.
She thinks maybe Ballarat would have a bit more buzz because it doesn't have Castlemaine draining all the coolness out of it.
One of the things I've found is that if you want the buzz in these places, you have to be the buzz. You have to create the buzz. You have to be the cultural capital yourself and not rely on it already being there. You have to create
it. You know, it does seem to me that both Bendigo and Ballarat, with all of that beautiful old goldfields architecture, have got a lot going for them. You know, they've got very good art galleries. They've got theatres. They've got a bit of cultural infrastructure
there. There's critical mass there. Another thing that I saw in the essay, relating to a city-country culture clash, was something you said about the students that you've had here in Melbourne, that they have very little connection with the country. Very few of them live there. They've only seen what they have seen in the media, which is not always complimentary or accurate, and they've spent little time there.
Yeah, well, that was one of the things I noticed. I was, my father was born in the Golden Valley, and so when I was growing up in the 50s, I had country cousins. You know, my grandparents lived on a farm. And so did a lot of the kids I went to school with. You know, we were sort of baby boomer generation, and not all of them, but quite a lot of them had uncles, or because in that post-war period, a lot of people of my father's age moved from the country to city jobs, either after the war or into the new expanding. He was a public servant in the sort of expanding professional classes. But I had a pretty good sense of life in the country, and I had cousins and all that sort of thing. Now, with post-war migration, plus demographic shifts, most of the post-war migrants came into the cities. And so some of the students I was talking about, they're people who were the children or the grandchildren of post-war migrants who moved into the Melbourne suburbs. They're not anti-country in any way. They just don't actually know anybody there. So it's not really part of their sense of Australia. And people's holiday, like, we went on our holidays back to visit my grandparents because Dad would go up there to help and things. But now people are a lot more likely to fly to Queensland. And so I was it was a tutorial I was taking, and there was a girl from Myrtleford, and she was doing the presentation, and I asked at some point, does everybody know where Myrtleford was? And about half the class had not a clue. And I said, well, don't you, when you're driving places, don't you sort of notice where places are? And then somebody said, oh, we never drive through the countryside in Victoria. So I said, well, where do you go for your holidays? They said, oh, we fly to Queensland. So there's that way in which the sort of the consciousness of the rural hinterland was absent for quite a lot of these students. And I found I was quite taken aback by that, because I'd always, in my map of Australia, you know, people have their own sort of personal geographies, that Goulburn Valley wedge had always been something that I thought about when I look at what the weather's doing. I think I notice what the weather's like on the other side of the divide.
Yeah.
You know, because, and, but it was clear that for a lot of people, there's no social links. So, and I think it's migration and it's demographic change too, because the cities have grown faster than the country.
Yeah, and one of the things I've seen as a result of that is you get two different cultures that speak across each other when there's national debates on important issues. So, for example, I had a Melbourne-based advocacy group that's wanted to come and do some things in Albury-Wodonga recently, and their idea is that they just rock up and hold a function and everyone will come and they'll be the fount of wisdom for all these people. Well, that's not how country people roll. You've got to show some respect. And and there is intelligence in these places, and there's a lot of practical people in these places that are actually doing things that city people just talk about. And I found that their approach to engaging with our community was flawed, and it was a result of these different cultures and languages at play.
And probably operating inside different social networks, different patterns of social networks. Because one of the things that's always struck me about the country is that things move through personal face-to-face networks.
Yeah.
And people, you've had people who've been there a long time and they know people and they have relatives, and that those networks are quite strong and a great resource for people in the country. But city organisation is more likely to operate by, you know, more like a marketing organisation or something, sending out your message and hoping that you'll capture the people who are going to be responsive to that message, rather than working through networks.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. I think moving back from a city to Albury-Wodonga, I found you're not of the community until you actually know people.
Yeah.
And you're part of these existing networks.
And
yeah. Yeah. My wife struggled with that a bit. Having grown up in Mount Gambier, I was a bit more familiar. But
yeah, did she grow up in Adelaide?
Yeah.
Once you have kids too, I think you get into the community more.
Yeah, well, it gives you opportunities to meet people and interact with people that you wouldn't otherwise.
Yeah.
Especially as an academic in a regional community.
That's true, yeah.
Yeah. Do you think, touching on that, that clash of cultures, that there is an existential dread that comes with city life, with being a small fish in a very big pond? And, but before you answer that, I take that from a passage where you've talked about these talking about the difference in images of the country versus the city, the country of sturdy independence, nearness to nature, friendly people, or backward and oppressively conservative.
Well, look,
stereotypes.
I think what I was trying to get at there, and I think this is true, is that the country and the city, they're geographic locations, but they're also cultural locations. And there's a long tradition in Western literary cultural thinking, you know, really going back to Virgil, probably, you know, and the classics, about country life and city life. And there's positives and negatives on both. So so there's the city as the dens of iniquity, you know, crowded, anonymous, cold, full of sin and temptation, you know, let your kids go to the city and you'll never see them again sort of thing. Or there's the city as this cosmopolitan place of possibility and where you can find out who you are, and, you know, it's exciting. So there's those. And the country, there's the same. There's the country as a place of community, of living closer to nature, of running your own life. Or there's the country as being in an oppressive, small community of sort of, you know, rednecks and imbeciles. You know, like if you think, you can think of all those images in films, like straw dogs, or you know. So they're both. The thing is, they're all. They're both. It's all true, and it all isn't, in the sense that different people's experiences are different. But if you look at cultural representations, you can see those two images being there. You can see them in journalism, in popular culture, and probably particularly in film. And also different people value different things in their life. I did an interview recently with a man who was just retiring, and he'd lived in Sydney, and he said, oh, well, I'm retiring to a small town. I grew up in a small town. I like small towns. I like the way they work. I would never retire to a small town. I would find it, I don't want to live in that sort of known world. Some people like it, some people don't. You know, so there's, they do provide different sort of possibilities for people, and that's good.
Yeah, depending on where you're at in life.
But I think it is that there are also these cultural images that are there, and that are there quite powerful.
Yeah. Now, I mentioned earlier of my need to flee my hometown because it was a suffocating environment for a number of reasons, which is why I was struck by this particular line from the essay where you said, hegemonic masculinity has persisted in the country far longer than in the city, and as the country Australia is a home to racism, xenophobia, misogyny, intolerance and homophobia. So do these attitudes hold greater currency in country areas where the intellectual environment does not exist as much to challenge them?
It's probably that, but I think it's also the fact that there's probably plenty of racist, homophobic, hegemonically masculine people in the city.
Oh, no doubt. Yeah.
But you can avoid them.
Mm.
I think the difference is so. I think scale makes a big difference. So if you're living in a small town and everybody knows you, you know, one of the things that the city provides is the degree of anonymity.
Mm.
You can, like in the street I live in, I talk to about 20% of the people in the street. You know, I'm greeting those, but I can basically, I'm not obliged to be friends with them in a way, because we're in a big world and we've got, everybody's got lots of options.
Yeah.
And I think that's the difference. Though I was also, I think, there looking at, there's some stuff on farms and the way farm properties got passed to male heirs, not female heirs. I mean, there are a lot of probably role patterns there, and it's partly there's not as many possibilities for people, but I think that's one of the reasons people flee, particularly when they're young and when they're working out their identities, or when they have a sense of possibility. They don't particularly want to be locked into some particular box because Mrs. Jones down the road is going to has a view of them based on when they were 14. You know that?
Yeah, I can relate to that idea of compression as well. Because when you're in a regional city, there's no class differentiation by geography. Everyone's mashed in together.
Yeah.
And in a way, we're in a city, if you're of a higher socioeconomic group, you can actively avoid anyone who's poor, basically.
Yeah,
In a country town, you can't. Their problems are your problems and vice versa.
Yeah. And there's an advantage and a disadvantage in that.
Yeah. Multiculturalism.
Yeah.
Now, I find this interesting because when we came to Albury-Wodonga, we noticed that it was very white.
Yep.
But it's not, if you dig under the surface. There's some new migrant communities coming in, like the Bhutanese, and we've got some students from that community at our university. So do you think, are regional centres new frontiers of multiculturalism, or is this a pattern that's popped up throughout Australia's history in country areas?
Well, thinking about the post-World War II migration, I suppose, certainly many more of the migrants went into the cities. Now, it's clear that it was plenty of Italians didn't, because a lot of them went into horticulture. And so they didn't go into sheep and wheat, but they did go into horticulture. So Golden Valley, the riverland sort of area around Mildura, Griffiths, the irrigated areas where there's plenty of Italians, as there had been up on the cane fields. There's not very many, but once the sort of Asian migration started in the 80s, not very many new Asian migrants have gone into the country. And so I think that when there started to be a debate about Australia's Asian migration. I think the difference between the country and the city then, in terms of what it looked like demographically, was really stark. And so people would come in from the city into the country. They'd get out at Central, just near RMIT, and they'd say, "Spot the Aussie." Because, of course, lots of those people, the Asian faces they were seeing, weren't new migrants. They were students, they were tourists, or whatever, and but they didn't know that. And they felt, all of a sudden, that their city looked different.
Mm.
Because there hasn't been much Asian migration into the countryside. So, now, since about 2000, and there being, you know, a lot more refugees coming, the country taking more refugees, there's been a sort of a more active program to try to settle refugee communities into some of the country towns, and that seems to have been working quite well. I mean, Shepparton, seems to have worked well. There'd been a very old Islamic community there, going right back to the 19th century, and so that gave it a little bit of a kernel to sort of grow around. But in terms of the sort of non-horticultural farming community, that stayed pretty white because the land stayed pretty much in families and got passed down in families, I think.
And with the Asian migration, it's tended to be urban here.
It's tended to be urban. They haven't
Is
been...
that because they're coming from urban settings?
No, I mean, I don't know what it is, actually. Mm. I mean, they don't seem to have gone into market gardening and that sort of thing. Mm. It may be that the Italians have got that all sewn up. I mean, I don't know. Or they wanted to stay with their compatriots more. But, I mean, it just is noticeable in terms of the statistics that the cities are now much more Asian.
Yeah. I have to say it does irritate me when skips get angry for foreigners congregating in their social groups or ethnic groups, because you go to London and who do Australians hang out with?
Yeah, exactly, I agree.
Yeah, it's the people that you're familiar and comfortable with in a possibly hostile environment. It's not rocket science.
Yeah, that's right.
Mm-hmm. Let's move on to politics now. In the essay, you quote Bob Catter talking about how the party system has worked to or privileges big city interests over the country. You hear Tony Windsor complaining that the 2010 election was fought in the western suburbs of Sydney. Why do these complaints surface?
Oh, well, they basically can surface because of numbers. I mean, elections are about numbers. Mm. And we have a majoritarian politics. I mean, the Australian electoral system, the electorates are based on the numbers of people inside of them.
Mm.
In the past, there was a skewing so that country electorates could have fewer people in them to try to increase representation. But if you have the bulk of your population living in the cities, of course, that's where the elections are going to be won and lost. And that's just the way our politics works. Now, Windsor said, and he's quite right, that a third of the people of our population live outside of our capital cities. Some of those, though, live not in what we think of as the country, but on the coastal strips between Sydney and Brisbane. And that's been a big shift. So when you look at the sort of demographic charts of Australia's population, about in the 1970s, there stops being a drain from the regions into the cities because you start to get a big build-up of population in those coastal communities, which were once rural dairy farming. And those electorates move away from National Party to becoming ones that are fought over between Labor and Liberal. But, I mean, it's just the nature of the numbers, I think, is the problem.
Mm. Another take on this might be that people's voting habits in country seats, especially blue ribbon country seats, where they vote for the same party, whoever it might be, generation after generation, means that governments and oppositions don't fight over those seats at elections. So they're not pork barrelling.
I suppose that's true. There's city electorates where that happens too.
Mm.
But I think the other thing to be said, though, is the country electorates have been more prepared to return independence than city electorates have. So, you know, like Windsor and Catter, and at the state level, we've had East Gippsland's returned independence, and up around Mildura has. So,
Now I live in Sophie Mirabella's seat.
Oh, lucky you!
And people who would be favourable to her being unseated say we'd get better outcomes in the seat if the seat was made more marginal, so there would be a contest.
Yeah.
Is there anything to that?
I think there probably is, because yeah. I think, you know, yeah, I think that that the parties want to win seats and safe seats get taken for granted. I mean, when I say it's not just a city problem, Bob Hawke was given the seat of Wills, mm. and he was Prime Minister, and he basically, Wills felt it was completely neglected mm. by him, and after he left, they actually, that's when Phil Cleary was elected as an independent, as a sort of a protest to Labor for having taken them so for granted. So I think it's the problem of the safe seat, both country and city.
Yeah. So does then that then behoove country people to be a bit more savvy in how they vote?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. And to and probably, I mean, in across the electorate anyway, you know, there's this process of de-alignment whereby people are much less loyal to a party than they used to be. Now, I would think that there's probably perhaps stronger patterns of loyalty in the country than in the city. There's probably people move around a bit less.
Mm-hmm.
There's probably, you know, one of the reasons the National Party's still got some political power is that it can deliver a vote with a minimum amount of sort of effort in advertising, because they can still rely on a traditional loyalty. In the way, that's much less the case now for Labor and Liberal.
Yeah, and that could be a spin-off effect of that conservatism feedback loop.
Yeah.
All right, now I'm going to end up by asking you about environmental issues. And you said in the essay, contemporary rural protests are mainly about environmental policies. And always the thing that comes to mind, the images of those angry farmers in Griffith burning copies of the Murray-Darling Basin Plan. Or people protesting alpine grazing. Now we've got the carbon tax, which is a very emotive issue. Now, it's clear that Australia's agricultural development model is flawed for a number of reasons. It makes it ecologically and economically unsustainable in a lot of places. We've got climate change, energy and food insecurity issues. International financial turmoil's influencing that as well. These are all pressing problems. Are people across the city-country divide capable of addressing these problems constructively without ripping each other to shreds?
Well, we hope so, don't we?
Yeah.
I mean, well, look, what I think about that is that there is a lot of good things happening in the country in terms of environmental action, and it's easy to pick on things like, you know, the Griffith farmers. And actually, there wasn't that many of them when you actually look at the footage. Mm. You know, maybe there's 40. You know, that it's use of protest politics. And I think that that sort of action on their part was really unfortunate, because it actually feeds this image of these people being sort of, you know, environmental. It's because you also have got the whole land care movement, which has been an enormously successful and innovative movement. You've got a lot of, you know, these organisations like Trust for Nature, where landowners sign up to try to restore vegetation on their land. There's actually, you know, the positive things don't attract the media in the way the protest stuff does. So I'm a bit more optimistic. I mean, I think we should be, particularly in the sort of settled agricultural areas where, I mean, it's much harder once you get out into the red dirt country, because there's just so much of it.
Yeah.
But in the sort of areas in Victoria, we should be paying, you know, the city in some, it's through some way, whether it's be through the carbon tax or whatever, should be prepared to pay for environmental services from people living in country areas, you know, the maintenance of wetlands or whatever. And if we are putting areas out of agriculture back into environmental things, then we pay for it. And we can pay maintenance. I mean, there's a lot of work to be done to maintain some of this stuff. So I think we have to be more innovative. But I do feel that the way certain sections of the country use the image of the greenie actually, I mean, it's political, but I think it's really not helpful. I mean, the mountain, the cattlemen grazing, what are we talking about? Six families that have got grazing licences, who were clearly just protecting their economic interests and mobilising as sort of a cultural heritage argument, which will get in a whole lot of other people who are not going to benefit in any way at all. You know, I think it's the worst sort of really selfish dog in the manger politics that the mountain cattlemen have been involved in.
I'm looking at the coal seam gas.
Yeah, that's
phenomenon
a big,
at the moment. And all of a sudden, you've got these urban environmentalists and agriculturalists and farming people who all of a sudden have common interests.
Yeah, no, that's very
interesting. And they still don't know how to talk to each other yet, but there's...
And that's very interesting, because throughout the 80s and 90s, when all the debate was on about Aboriginal land title, my view is that the mining industry, which had the most to lose, used farmers and pastoral interests as a sort of a front, really, because they were able to evoke sympathy. Nobody's ever very sympathetic to the miners. You know, the poor people whose family farm's going to be, you know, put at risk because of a wick or something. And so they were together. But now the interests of farmers and the mining industry are really very different, and it's a new politics. So still, you know, so watch this space thing. I can't quite work out how it's going to play out, except that state governments appear to be backing the mining industry because they want the resources royalties.
Yeah, and but the spin-off is that you're seeing conservative communities getting really radicalised politically in a way that would be unconscionable 10 years ago.
Yeah, yeah. No, that's right. It's a real new politics.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Judy, thanks a lot for joining us on the podcast today. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you.